Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Ellen, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So tonight, I have the pleasure of introducing Clay. He is from the Serenity House of Buford and the 7-Up group. I hear he is storing some really, really good stories about he and this one here in early sobriety. So we want to hear them.
All right.
So we want to hear your story first.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Clay, and I am an alcoholic. First of all, I've got a ton of support here tonight, which is awesome. There's 20 people I know from coming group, from church, from my group. It's awesome. So thank you all for coming. I took some notes because the last time I winged it, and it took me a half an hour. And I'm told I have to be here longer than that. So, and thanks to NABA for having me. I want to read something out of the book to start with before I get going. It's a paragraph in the back of the book called Spiritual Experience. The chapter is called that. Paragraph goes, most emphatically we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. And I'll get into why that's important to me later. My sobriety date is November 3rd, 2008.
Wow.
Thank you. I was born in El Paso, Texas on this date in 1962. Today's my birthday. Happy birthday.
Do that again.
Look, if I get all this going at one time, it may not get stopped, okay? So I started out, I was born in El Paso. At a year old, I moved to New Mexico. At 2 years old, I moved to Puerto Rico. At 3 years old, I moved to St. Croix. And at 4 years old, I moved to Los Angeles. And I was in Los Angeles for 10 years. And I was a behavior problem as long as I can remember. I was always in trouble, at least going back to first grade. I remember some things before that, but I don't remember being in trouble. But I was a behavior problem since day one. I also was very smart. I got great grades. I was always the one picked to help the slower children, but I was a mess. I can remember in first grade one time there was laminated flashcards, and I cut them with scissors, and my teacher, who was very cool, she was a hippie, had one of those chairs that hung in the corner, and she would swing in it and read. It was very cool. But she got mad because I cut this thing, and she sent me to the principal's office. And instead of going to the principal's office, I went to the bathroom and hid for what I thought was a reasonable amount of time and went back to class, and nobody knew the difference. But I was always, I mean, that starts just, you know, not doing what I'm told to do, no matter what. Throughout elementary school, I was always, supposed to come home when the lights go on, you know, when the street lights come on. I never did that. I was grounded all the time. I lied all the time. My mouth is clean. It's had a lot of soap. My mouth's been washed out with soap a lot. like I said, I was really smart. I got really good grades, A's and B's, mostly A's. But my parents never thought that was good enough. They wanted me to have straight A's. I was bullied a lot. Just always bullied. I was never good at sports. I was the last one to be picked for teams. I started taking piano lessons at age 6 from my mom, which didn't work out very long because my mom and I still don't get along. but then later, a few years later, I decided I wanted to play the piano again, so she sent me someplace else to have lessons, and so I played piano for a long time, but I was never very good at it. I just went, took lessons, blah, 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 blah. Fourth grade, I started going to shrinks at the same time I got accepted into the gifted program at school. And the shrink put me on Ritalin. And also, we had this program between the shrink and my teacher and my parents. If I acted out in any way at school, they would send me home. It doesn't matter what time of day it was. So I figured that out pretty soon. So by 10 o'clock every day, I was going home. Like, this is cool. I can just go home. So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of kid I was. I was just, you know, too smart for my own good. I did not win. I went to the spelling bee, came in second. I went home and lied to my folks and told them I'd won the spelling bee. And they said, oh, yeah. I said, oh, great. So you're going on to regionals or whatever? And I said, yeah, and blah, 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 blah. And then the next thing you know, they're like, why aren't you going to regionals? I don't know. They changed their mind. Whatever. It was, yeah. I got into band in seventh grade. Played clarinet. Was good enough to, in eighth grade, they promoted me up to the highest of concert bands. And in eighth grade, I started skipping class. That's when I started skipping class. We moved to Rome in my freshman year of high school. Now, I don't know, some of you are old enough, some of you are not, but some of you are old enough to remember in 1976, for 2 years, this country had been painted red, white, and blue. It was our bicentennial, 200 years. This was a big deal in this country. And we moved to Rome in June of that year, and I was pissed because I was not going to be home July 4th for the big party, right? And then I get to Rome, of course, and realize that 200 years eat shit, because I was going to school on a road that Roman soldiers marched on 2,000 years ago. So, but I was mad. I acted out all the time. Dad's company paid for my sister and I to go to these very posh prep English-speaking prep schools over there. And so I went to Notre Dame International, which was affiliated with the university, and it's all run by brothers. I got to get back to some of that stuff. So I was indoctrinated into Catholicism right there. I'd known a little bit about Protestantism from earlier, and I'll get back to that in a second. But I was indoctrinated in Catholicism there, and that definitely was not for me. And I was skipping class and acting out, and they were not having any of that. This was a very rigid, do it our way or the highway kind of thing. And so I did it the highway because that's what they asked me to do. So I was there a year, and so the next year I had to go to a lesser school where normal kids went. And then they kicked me out too because I wasn't going to class and I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. But I want to touch on the religion part back when I was young. When I was very young, mom and dad took us to church, but by 7 or 8, we quit going to church. My mom and dad were not Christians. They were brought up, especially my father was brought up in Southern Baptist, born and raised here in Atlanta, Southern Baptist, and they were in church every time the doors were open, and he hated it, and he rebelled against it. And so the only reason they took us to church when we were kids was to give us the concept of spirituality. So I had that concept, but I didn't believe it either. I didn't believe in the whole, you know, man on the cross and all that. It just sounded like a bunch of hooey to me. Then my parents started going to classes. They would go to a Judaism. They would have a Judaism class for 6 months. And they would come home and we'd sit around the dinner table and talk about Judaism. And then they'd go to a Hindu class. And they'd come home and we'd talk about Hindu. And we'd talk about Buddhism. And we'd talk about Muslim. And we'd talk about all kinds of different religions. So I was indoctrinated with that from age like 9 to 13 or so. So I got a round education, scientific, historical education on the different religions, but nothing about us believing in a higher power at all, just the concept of what they were. So anyway, then like I said, we went to Italy and I got the Catholicism thing, and that was definitely not right. It was in Italy, however, is where I got drunk the first two times. The first time, we had barely been in Italy a week, and my dad's boss and his wife invited us over for the family over for lunch. And they started feeding us wine. I was 14, my sister was 13, and my dad is an alcoholic, or was, he's passed now. He was an alcoholic, and this guy, this boss, was also an alcoholic, but they started feeding my sister and I wine, and I was digging it, and fed us a lot of wine, and then after dinner started feeding, I think they were giving my sister amaretto because it was sweet, and giving me strega, which is much like ouzo, or it's a licorice-flavored liqueur, and I lapped it up. It was fantastic, and then another time, my sister had gone out, my mom and dad were out, and I was home alone, and I decided to get into my mom's rum. I'd seen her drink rum and Coke, so I went up to the place and got myself some Coca-Cola, and came back, and I probably drank a half a fifth of rum that night, white Bacardi, at 14 years of age, and puked up the stairs and puked back down the stairs to try to get a mop to clean all the puke up, and for whatever reason, I did not get caught, probably because my mom and dad were drunk when they came home, so they didn't notice, because there's no way I was able to clean it up that well. but I knew that I liked it. Like, I knew from the first time I started drinking that I was an alcoholic, that I liked alcohol, because it changed the way I felt. You know, I was always picked on, nobody liked me, or so I thought. And this changed all that. Like, I was cool all of a sudden. Nobody around, but I was cool. We moved back to L.A. in 77, so I was 15. Flunked that year. Joined the band again. And because I'd been out of band for almost 2 years, they sent me to the practice room. I wasn't allowed to join the band. So I'm sitting in the practice room by myself, so that didn't work out. Flunked out sophomore year. We moved to Toronto for my junior year and started going to school there. I got a paper route. I was 16. I got two paper routes, the evening route and the morning route. And so I knew when everybody was home, so I started breaking into houses. Because I knew when they were home or not, right? So I broke in the houses. But I wasn't a smart thief. All I was looking for was cash. I didn't know how to fence anything. So I was just looking for cash. And three of those houses, there were 30 houses in all. One of those houses, they left the keys in the car. And in Toronto, it gets cold in the winter. So I'd go to their house first, and I'd get in their car, and I'd deliver my papers, and then I'd leave the car. True story. Wow. But three of those houses I burned to the ground.
What?
With the concept of I was covering up my fingerprints. Not real bright, I understand. Shut up, Don. So anyway, and I was, again, all through the years, in Italy they had me going to a shrink that hardly spoke English. We get back to California, I'm going to a shrink again. We get to Toronto, I'm going to a shrink again because I'm a constant behavior problem. In school, at home, everything, I'm a constant behavior problem. So when I got arrested for the arson and the B&Es, my parents took me straight to the shrink and said, hey, what do we do with this guy? Well, the shrink happened to be in the building of a psychiatric hospital. And the guy said, well, we'll put him in the forensic unit. For those that don't know what that means, forensics is for criminals. It was the criminal part of the psychiatric hospital. And I remember the first night I was there, I was scared. I'm 16 years old and scared to death, thinking nobody loved me because here they locked me away in this place. And all I could think of was, I miss my dog. And the guy that was in my room with me, the only thing he said to me for the 3 days that I saw in there was, if you carry a knife at night, paint it black. That scared the shit out of me. I now thoroughly understand what that means. You don't want it flashing around at night. But it scared the shit out of me at the time. This guy's going to knife me. But because of that, so through all that, oh, and one other time in that, before I went, got locked up, one of the people from school said, hey, let's go over to this gal's house. Her mom's gone. We've got a bottle of lemon gin. And this shit tasted horrible. But I drank about half the bottle, and then the other three people drank the other half. And I was very inappropriate with the girls that were there. And then they said, well, it's time to go home. You know, it's school's out. We got to go home. And I said, well, you can't take me home like this. I'm wasted. And it's wintertime in Toronto, so it's cold out. There's snow on the ground. I said, all right, take me to the library. And the library was down a hill. The driveway was down a hill. They let me out at the top of the hill. And I proceeded to lay down in the snowbank right there. And I passed out in the snowbank on the side of the road. And I guess I don't know the details exactly, but apparently one of the gals that was with us called my house and said, did Clay make it home okay? And mom's like, no, I don't know where he is. And okay, well, we left him here. And so my mom pulls up and finds me laying passed out on the side of the road, trashed. But again, that was okay. I was okay with the booze. I really dug it. I get into the loony bin, and they teach me how to deal with people, how to not be such an arrogant prick, so that people didn't like me. People started liking me. It's also where I found out what pot was. Somehow somebody had smuggled some pot in, and we closed the door and put wet towels so that the orderlies didn't know, and so that's where I smoked pot the first time. And I get out, and I have to go to another school, so now that's the fifth high school that I've been to. And I met some people. The people I met were potheads and drinkers. This is okay. Now I've got friends. These people are like me. I still have some of those friends. In fact, I was just talking to Lincoln about one of them today on the way down here. But I was able to make friends. But again, I fucked up school and I was kicked out. And my parents kicked me out of the house. Kicked out of school, and then my parents kicked me out of the house. So 17 years old, I've got my own apartment. All my friends are still in school. So where you go when one of your friends has his own apartment when you're in high school? You go to his house, right? So everybody was coming to my house. Well, it was a big party all the time. I got a job in the restaurant industry so that I could eat. I didn't have to pay for food. I could spend it on booze and drugs. And there's just make sure I'm not missing anything. There was a lot of parties going on, and there was a lot of pot, a lot of beer, a little bit of whiskey, but mostly beer back then. But from jump, I couldn't just have two beers. From the beginning, I was drinking until I passed out, or there was no more. Smoked a lot of pot, did a lot of acid, lots and lots of LSD back in the late 70s and early 80s. That was a lot of fun. It really was. Butts and walls melt, and yeah. But anyway, like I said, so I got jobs in the restaurant industry. Let's see here. Bear with me here. So that went on until the result of the break and enters and the arson. They ended up dropping the break and enters, and they gave me 3 years. Because I'd spent 6 months in the loony bin, they gave me 3 years probation for the arson. So I have to serve that out. So once the 3 years was up, I was 20-ish, and my parents decided, and I kind of agreed with them for whatever reason, that I should move back to the States and join the military. That would straighten me out. Because I tried to go back to school a couple times, and that I was failing all the time. I'd hook up with the people that were drinking and smoking pot and doing speed and doing acid. I mean, that's what I did. And so anyway, so 1983, February of 83, my probation was over. And I moved to Orlando, Florida, where my grandparents lived. My dad's parents lived in Orlando. And they let me move in, and back then you didn't have to take classes for a GED. You could go write the test, and if you passed, you had a GED. So I went and bought, or my grandparents bought, a big, thick book on GED. And like I said, I'm pretty smart, so I was able to go through that quick enough. And then the next week I took the test, and I passed through flying colors, and I go to join the military. Wow. And no, I didn't join the military. I went to join the military. I tried to join the military. And I went to the Army, and I went to the Navy, and the Marines, and the Coast Guard, and everybody else. They didn't have the Space Guard yet, but I'm probably where I fit in. But they wouldn't take me because I was honest with them and told them that I had been convicted of 3 counts of arson in Canada. Now, I probably didn't have to tell them that because they wouldn't have checked Canadian records, but I did, and so they wouldn't take me. That was, you know, I don't understand that. Military won't take you for burning houses down even though they want you to go kill people. I don't get that, but that's okay. I don't understand that theory. But anyway, they wouldn't take me, and so now I'm stuck in Orlando with my grandparents. And in the meantime, my dad's company moved my dad to New Orleans. And he moved to New Orleans before my mom and my sister, because he had to be there for work. Mom and my sister were selling the house up in Toronto. So I moved in with my dad, who's an alcoholic, in New Orleans. You got it. Dad and I had a good time. I got a job. He had his job, and I was selling cars. I was not a very good car salesman at the time, but that's what my job was. And he and I would sit up all night long, in the evening, and drink scotch all night, and it was perfect. And then they ended up buying a house across the lake. Mom and Dad bought a house across the lake. So I moved with them, and within a couple of days, I was out the house, or a month or whatever. Had a job, and I was out of the house and living in my own place again. And, you know, hang tight. Again, I'm hanging out with all the partiers. That was my MO, and I was drinking and back to my regular drinking and smoking all the time. Doing acid when I could find it, smoking hash, smoking whatever I could find to change the feeling in me. Because, again, that's what this is all about, is changing the feelings. Met a chick. She was willing to take me in. And you'll recognize in my story that the only time that I really had a place of my own or that a place that I could call home was when some chick was taking care of me. Other than that, I was couch hopping or I was homeless, and we'll get into that. But this chick was willing to take care of me. She was codependent and just wanted somebody to take care of, and boy, was I that guy. Took advantage of her horribly. She would give me her credit card, and I would just use it to the max and go buy booze and just cheated on her, and I was horrible. And we dated on and off for years, and she kept putting up with me, and I keep going back. I don't want to get in too much of the partying. So, but spent 10 years in the New Orleans area. And if anybody's been in New Orleans, you know that they don't tell you when to stop at night.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't have sense enough to know when to stop at night. So I drank all the time. And I awoke in Florida several times, not knowing how I got there. And awoke in Mississippi several times. Because in the middle of the night, we're partying, and somebody says, "Let's go to Florida." I said, "Okay." That was me. And you know, one time, me and my buddy met two chicks, and we were they were going down for spring break to Fort Walton, and so we said, "Okay, we'll join you there." And we didn't have a car. We got on our bicycles and started riding our bicycles to Fort Walton. He got a flat, so we hitchhiked the rest of the way. And then we get down there, and the chicks' dudes were like, "No, you're not staying here in our hotel." And so hitchhiked home, off and on, stayed in the restaurant industry again because I could eat. But if there was not a gal involved in my life, I was couch hopping or I was sleeping in abandoned houses or something. I could never keep a place of my own. I met my first wife in New Orleans. Her family partied like my parents did, but if they were a good family, like I was brought up to go to be married into a good family, and she had a good computer job, and I thought, okay, this is good. I got stability. This is conservative, good. And I fucked that up too. And I was married to her 3 years, 1 month, and 7 days. And she moved me to Akron, Ohio. I had a really good job up there, and cheated on her, and she was a lovely lady. She still is a lovely lady. She lives in Greenville, South Carolina now, and we're friends now. But one time we had gotten into hot air ballooning, and one of our hot air balloonist friends was throwing a party in Buffalo, New York. And I had to work. So Karen's my next wife. Kim drove up to Buffalo to go to the party Friday afternoon, and I had to work that weekend, or that's what I told her anyway. And she left around 4, and by 5, I had my car packed and took the dog and drove back to New Orleans. No note, no nothing, just left her. Yeah, it's crazy and stupid and all kinds of things. Meanwhile, I'd wrecked her car several times. The guy at the body shop said, "We should give you a discount for all the times you've been here." Because I wrecked her car 4 or 5 times. I got my first DUI in Ohio. They gave you 3 days in jail. That was what they gave you. There might have been some fines involved, but there was no probation or anything. They gave you 3 days in jail. And you could check in when you wanted. So I checked in at 6 o'clock or whatever it was, and by 6 in the morning, the jail was full. So they said, "You can go home, time served." So I did 12 hours for my 3 days. Anyway, I moved back to New Orleans, and I'm still partying. Go back to the same job. They helped me out. And then my buddy and I, same guy that hitchhiked with me to Florida and back, met two more chicks, and they were moving to Orlando, and we thought, "Oh, we'll go work for the mouse." Right? Go work for the mouse. And we've all talked about, those of us in the program, we've talked about geographical changes, right? And we thought, "Oh, this is what we need." we'll go work for the mouse. So we follow these two chicks, drive us down there. And then we get there, and their dudes are like, no, you're not staying here. So now we're in Orlando, and my grandparents are not taking me in, or my buddy. And so we're homeless, and we don't know what to do. And I end up being homeless for 6 months, lived in the Salvation Army, was sober for that time, because if you live at the Sally Ann, they, at least back then, I don't know what it is now, but they would breathalyze you when he came in. And so I was sober for 6 months, minus about 3 days that he and I would stay out and drink, but for the most part. And for those of you that haven't been homeless, it's hard to get out of being homeless. Mm-hmm. That is a difficult, difficult thing to do, because you're working out of labor pools for minimum wage, and you're trying to find three hots and a cot every night, and it's just difficult to get out. Fortunately, the Sally Ann helped me, worked with me. You know, I explained that my industry is restaurant industry, and I'm going to have to work nights, and they let me come in late. They would breathalyze me every night, but they'd let me come in late, and I was able to get some money underneath me, and they would let me use their iron to iron my black and whites for work, and then met another chick, and she put me up, and I cheated on her too, and I drank all the time once I was out. Met my second wife, Karen, the woman that I still love and adore. She was a customer of mine, and she would come in the afternoons, and she and her girlfriend would throw back two quick martinis and go back to work. And I asked her out just for a whim. I knew she was moving to Atlanta, but I asked her out on a whim just to have a date, and she said yes, and I fell in love with her the first night. And she parted with me from then on. And she moved to Atlanta, and we had a long-distance relationship for a while. Then I moved up here, and we got married. And I started getting DUI after DUI after DUI after DUI, and wrecked cars and et cetera. But again, I got to get into the solution here soon. So fifth and sixth DUI were within 3 months of each other. And my lawyer managed to get them both tied into what's called DUI court. For those of you who don't know what DUI court is, it's a very intense probation where they can search your house at any time of the day or night. They can call you in for a pee test at any time of the day or night. Minimum of 3 AAs a week. I'd never been to AA before. But a minimum of 3 AA meetings a week, 3 counseling sessions a week at the beginning. You go to court once a week to be in front of the judge, and if you fuck up, you get sanctioned and you have to go to jail. Through the years, I'd been to jail for 30 days here, 10 days there, 20 days there, whatever. Through this thing, I did probably a year total before I finally really fucked up, and they found mushrooms in my freezer that I had been keeping for when I got out of probation. But in the meantime, I'd come to AA, and I started hearing the similarities instead of the differences. And they talked about spirituality, and I was anti-spirituality, because I was the scientific type that talks about it in the book. And so, you know, I knew the history of religion and all that. But I also looked at the hypocrisy of religion, and so that wasn't for me until I read that book, that chapter on spiritual experience. Now, why that's at the back of the book, I have no idea. It should be straight up front. And like Bill, my ego is huge, and so I should have written this book, not Bill. That's just my feeling. But that whole chapter talks about being open-minded and you know, how about the possibility of there being a God? And Herbert Spencer's quote at the back, at the bottom of that chapter, talking about being open-minded, and that made sense. And then I started thinking about it in my scientific and historical brain, and you know, well, how did the universe start? Well, it started with the Big Bang. Well, what happened before the Big Bang? Right? So I had to throw something in there. So anyway, I started paying attention to y'all. I found a sponsor. I started doing steps, quasi. And that was in 2008, just when I got sober, as I said. And my wife got sick in 2017. She had pancreatic cancer. And I started paying a lot of attention to her because she was my meal ticket, right? She's the one that kept the roof over my head and the food in the fridge, because all my money that I was making was going towards booze. It was going towards trips. It was going towards, I didn't put any money into the household. She wanted it, but I wouldn't do it. I was partying. And anyway, so I was scared. I was scared I was going to lose her. Because I didn't love her still. I didn't know what love was. This program has taught me what love is. Thank God for this program. She got sick, and I was with her through it all. I would go to every doctor appointment, and I went to every chemo appointment, and I went to every radiation appointment and surgery, and yada, yada, yada. And 2020... And I'm going to meetings, and I've got my sponsor, and I'm kind of doing the steps. And 2020 happened, and we all know what happened in 2020. And, you know, places shut down, and there were Zoom meetings. But I kind of felt, this is probably my own perception, but I felt like the rest of the country was all divided at the time, and I thought that the rooms were getting political, and that's not what I was going to the rooms for. And so I quit going. In the meantime, I had found a church that, and some of my church people are here, and I'm so thankful that y'all are here. Thank you so much. That kind of goes along with my concept of a higher power. It's not exact, but I've learned how to translate. I can walk into a Catholic church today and translate what they're saying into what it means to me for a higher power. This program has taught me this. Open your mind, Clay. Open your mind. I say that to everybody. All my sponsees that have a hard time with the God's concept, just keep an open mind. And so I quit going to AA, and I talked to my sponsor, and I said, look, I'm not liking this, but I'm in church. I'm going to church. The solution is spiritual. Says that. And he said, well, everybody, my sponsor, and I had to give up sponsees, and so I had to talk to my sponsor about this, and he says, well, everybody follows their own path, and if you feel that's your path, go for it. And so I did, and I quit going. And my wife in 2021 got really, really, really sick, and she was in and out of the hospital. She'd be in the hospital for 4 days, and she'd be out for two, and then she'd be in for four and out for two. And finally they said, there's nothing else we can do. What do you want to do? She was in the hospital at the time, and I said to her, well, you got two choices. You can stay in the hospital where nobody can visit you because of COVID. Nobody's allowed to go. For some reason, they allowed me to go. But nobody else, none of the other family was allowed to come. And you can stay in the hospital and keep getting blood transfusions and nobody can visit you. Or you can come home and be able to say goodbye to your family, to your kids and your grandchildren. We have five grandchildren. Or you can come home and say goodbye. And so that's what she did. In September of 2021, she came home and went into hospice at the house. Family from all over the country came and said goodbye to her. It was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. I mean, I had 40 million people in my house, but it was beautiful for her. The priest came. She was born and raised Catholic, though she didn't go to church. She wanted a priest for last rites. The priest comes and goes. She says, okay, I got my ticket punched. That was her quote. Loved it. And she passed away on November 17th of 2021. And though I was prepared, I thought I knew she was dying, I wanted to crawl inside of a bottle of Jägermeister so bad. And my church isn't open for six meetings a day. But the Serenity House is, and they have a 7 o'clock in the morning meeting we call 7-Up Group. It's my home group. It's the best group on the planet. But I knew they were going to be open at 7, and so I was there at 7 in the morning because I played the tape through. This program has taught me to play the tape through. When I have an issue and I think about doing something stupid, I don't have the obsession for liquor anymore, except for that one time when my wife died. But anything I do stupid, I know where I can go. I can play the tape through. Well, if I do that, then this is going to happen and this is going to happen, because I think clearly now. So I was able to play the tape through, and I knew I'd either be in jail or dead very soon if I crawled into that bottle. So I came to a meeting, and you people welcomed me back with open arms. My sponsees welcomed me back with open arms. My sponsor welcomed me back, and now that she's been gone for a year and a half, I have immersed myself in both church and AA to the point where I am busy all the time. In church, I have been asked to be in the choir. People ask me to do things now and join them in things. That never happened before. I've been asked to join the choir. I've been asked to, the pastor has this thing she calls the apostles. It's 12 of us get around once a quarter and we talk about God. I've been asked to be the cook for this other thing that we do once a month. And so I provide food for 30 to 70 people, depending on, and I never know how many it's going to be. So I a lot of times have a lot of leftovers, but that's not neither here nor there. But I'm asked to do things in the church, and people want me to belong, and they, I know everybody at church, and they all know me, and they like me, and AA, I've been asked to be on the board, and so I'm on the board at Serenity House, and at 7-Up, and our 7-Up group is awesome, isn't it? Isn't it just the best meeting on the planet? And everybody loves me, and we go whitewater rafting, and I went to see the play Wicked yesterday with Morgan, and it was amazing, and people want me to do things today. People want me around because I'm doing the next right thing. I'm doing the next right thing. You know, I help out with parties at the Serenity House. Back-to-back weeks, I was the cook for a couple parties. I'm invited to things, baseball games, concerts, plays. I was asked to be a dog sitter. Like somebody trusted me with their animals. In their house. Like not even in my house. I was a lady sleep in their house. And they didn't worry about me stealing their shit. Because that would have happened. And it's an overwhelming feeling. I asked my sponsor not too long ago. I was like, I'm being asked to do all these things. I'm asked to be on the board of Shobi. I'm asked to be all these things at church and be a sponsor. So many people have asked me to be a sponsor in the last 12 months. And I called my sponsor. I was like, I'm not worthy of all this. And he said to me something so profound. He said, you're not worthy of service? And I went, oh. Yeah, I'm worthy of service. I'm worthy of helping someone else. That's what I do today. I try to help somebody else in everything I do all the time. I stop at stoplights. I keep bubbles in my car, and I blow bubbles at stoplights because it makes people smile. I get smiles from kids. I get smiles from rednecks with the nuts on the back of their truck. Like, I get smiles from people because I'm blowing bubbles. If I can make somebody else smile, that makes me smile. And I think that helps the world. I heard something the other day. I have had a resentment against my parents forever. As to my dad, who passed away in 2005, I carried this resentment for years up until earlier this year. I heard somebody in a meeting say, and I've heard this a million times, but this happens in AA. He did the best he could. I've heard that a lot. We've all heard that about our parents, right? They did the best they could. Well, this time I heard it. And I went, oh. Because he had baggage too. And he did what he could do. He's carrying all this other luggage. And here I am, and he's trying to help. I heard it. I hear things. This is what we do in this program. We hear things for the first time that we've heard a million times. I love this program. This program taught me about God, and it taught me about my concept of God. You know, when they go to church, they give you a God. Here's your God. Catholic Church says, here's your God, and it comes with a mother. Right? You go to a Protestant church, and you got God and the Son and the Father and the Holy Spirit. You got three of them. All the different churches have their own gods. The Hindus got 15 gods. Romans got 12 gods. You know, Bacchus is one of my favorite gods, by the way, still to this day. But you come into AA, and they give you a choice. You get to pick your own concept of a higher power. And that made all the sense in the world. And now that I've come to realize, and now I'm a regular at church, and I'm one of the ones that sit on the front row, you can ask the four people that sit on the front row of the church that have been listening to the same pastor for 25 years, and ask them what their concept of a higher power is, and every one of them will tell you a different thing. And they've been going to the same church. We all have a different concept of a higher power. But for me, that's the most important thing about this program, is grab a concept of a higher power. Because he, she, it, divine spirit, whatever you want to call it, is going to get you through this. It's going to get you through it one day at a time. And I'm going to end with this last thing. So when you lose your cell phone, what do? You look for it, right? And that's how you find it. When you lose your keys, you look for your keys. And that's how you find it. If I'm looking for God, I'm going to find it. If I don't look for God, I'm not going to find God. If I don't look for my keys, I'm not going to find my keys. Keep looking. Thanks. Peace. Oh, that's
great. Thank you so much, Clay. That was amazing. Such inspiration and hope. That always makes me happy. Sorry, I have asked Deborah to come and give out the chips.
Hi, Deborah. Hi, babe. Deborah
and
Alcoholics.
Hey, Deborah.
Clay, I enjoyed you. Thank you for your service. Mm-hmm. Yes. Great story. You made me laugh. I love the ones that make me laugh.
Yes.
We mark our sobriety time with chips. We're offering a white chip tonight. New way of life. Come and join us. Here you go.
All right.
Well, my head was in tomorrow, and my feet followed history. I had an insane notion I could hoodoo everything around me. No. 'Cause too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. I got a nudge from the judge, Lord, and put me in recovery. But the flow